Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
Hi, this is Amy Helfeld from Seattle, Washington, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Amy, thank you so much for your support and to everybody that backed our Kickstarter at the end of last year, which has enabled us to carry on all year long and produce the Tennis Podcast for you. Hope you're enjoying it. We certainly are. Catherine's here. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, David.
Hello, Matt. You all right?
Hello. Yes, fine. Thank you.
Good. We have had the most wonderful weekend watching old tennis matches from Rome, which we are going to relive with you today from 1992, the story of Gabriella Sabatini's extraordinary run in Rome, 4 titles in 5 years. And also, we'll just talk about her more generally. She's one of those players that tends to get forgotten, I'm afraid to say, including by us. I can't think of many times that we've mentioned the name Gabriella Sabatini over the last 8 years of the Tennis Podcast, and we're going to put that right today. She also turned 50 as well over the weekend, so it feels like a good time to do that. And we're going to go back to the 2006 men's final between Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. I dare say many more of you will remember that one, and maybe some of you watched it with us over the weekend. So lots to talk about. Before we do that, let's just mention the news of the week, which is that more tennis tournaments have been cancelled up until July the 31st on the ATP circuit, and the ITF events, the wheelchair events, have been announced. On the men's side, tournaments like Gstaad, Borstad, Kitzbühel and Newport all cancelled because of the coronavirus, and we await to find out what will happen with the American swing in August. But I mean, it doesn't sound great, so we'll have to wait and see. Several WTA events until mid-July cancelled as well, but no great surprise, I'm afraid. Catherine, I should say as well, following on from songs that could be used for the coronavirus era, a particular mention for EJ Stanton on Instagram, who suggests, "Don't stand so close to me" from the Police.
Yep. Yep.
Acceptable?
Yeah, that's I've heard that mentioned a lot over the last. We were going for more. I don't want to diminish EJ's contribution there, but we were going for for more specifically songs that reference the absence of crowd.
Right. So
rather than sort of general coronavirus social distancing song gags, which I feel is anyone else a bit over sort of coronavirus social distancing song gags? No.
I'm just sort of over the whole thing generally.
Yeah. It's a very difficult time for cynical people with a dry sense of humour, because there's a lot of well-intentioned sort of sickly peppiness and sort of, we're all in this together and we'll come through this, and have you considered crafting? You should be crafting. Oh, we're all going to come out of this as better, more well-rounded people. And, you know, if you poo-poo all that, then you're an aren't you? But I'm so over all of that.
This, folks, is Catherine Whittaker, who has just shown us her latest 2,000-piece jigsaw, which makes two in a row that she's knocked together now. And she's also on about her 50th podcast of the year, with 2 weeks' worth of dailies to come during Roland Garros. Peppy Catherine.
Yeah, but I'm not smugly telling people. Have you considered podcasting? It'll make you a better human being during these challenging times.
It's definitely made me a better person.
Have you always done jigsaws?
No. I mean, I have, you know, on occasion in over the years done the odd jigsaw, but no, it's definitely... It's a necessity, Matt. I'm not doing this to self-improve. I'm doing it to pass the time.
I'm just impressed, because not to call them out or anything, they might even be able to hear me through the walls, but my parents have started jigsaws and they're really not very good at them.
How can you be bad at jigsaws unless you've got bad eyesight?
I mean, you've done about five of them in the space. I would not have been able to do one.
More than that.
Like colossal jigsaws. We're talking 2,000 pieces. My parents are struggling with 500 pieces. Maybe they need help.
I could just hand it over to my kids. If I was doing a jigsaw, there's no way I'd be doing it, because I'd just lose interest.
But it's just... No, but you don't lose interest. It's oh God, I'm going to sound like one of these awful peppy people. It's very mindful. It gets me off my phone.
Oh, that's good.
You can still sort of be watching the telly. Well, obviously not physically. You can have something on the telly in the background and be paying attention to it. But it gets you off your phone. It concentrates the mind. Oh God, I hate myself. Move on.
I can multitask, is what you're saying. Awesome.
Okay, well, you specifically cannot multitask, so I would say it's a non-starter for you.
Okay, all right, fine. Meanwhile, folks, we have been putting photos on our social media channels of ourselves in 1992, where possible, because Matt didn't exist in 1992, and 2006, respectively. Matt has created quite a stir with his picture of a tennis magazine on which he... as a child, Prodigy is on the front cover, wielding his racket like Richard Gasquet, aged 9.
Except there's no strings in the racket.
Ah, that's the giveaway. So what happened?
That's the only giveaway,
yeah.
What was going on there, Matt? Because a few people were taken in by it.
It's my absolute, probably favourite thing that's ever happened to me, that people actually think I was on the cover of Tennis Magazine, aged 10. It was just at Wimbledon in the LTA tent, where you could go up and have your photo taken in front of a green screen, and they would then imprint it onto... It was Ace Tennis Magazine. And yes, they put my photo up there alongside the words, the future Wimbledon champion.
Yeah, as if you were going to win all future Wimbledon titles.
Exactly. I was going to be the defining Wimbledon champion of the future.
And having experienced his game, I can tell you it could have happened.
You've been likened to a young Marin Cilic in appearance.
Yeah. Not sure what to say about that.
Well, he won US Open, so I'd go with that.
Yeah, no, great. I'm strongly in favour of all comparisons to professional tennis players.
A singular US Open title is not, you know, all Wimbledon titles, though, is it? That's still an underachievement relative.
I don't think we're actually doing any matches from 2007 for Tennis Relived. Who knows how long Tennis Relived will be going on? We may have to come to 2007 at some point. But I actually went back the following year and appeared on the front cover again.
Let's just put it up as a sort of extra, because that's what the people want.
Well, I'm in my school uniform in that one.
I took 2 full days to find a photo from 1992 that I could deem acceptable. And even that one had me wearing a World Wrestling Federation T-shirt and a Chicago Bulls
hat. The first one David submitted to me was taken at a distance of about 25 metres. And it was unclear whether it was actually David, because the face was so blurry.
I'm so ashamed of myself from that period of my life, that finding pictures...
Yeah, you sent some quite deep, profound messages on our WhatsApp group about your life back then.
It was an interesting
I was a bit
period.
Worried about sending you into the garage to sort through more photos of that period.
You and me
thought
both.
You might never emerge from that dark yeah. hole of shame.
I love how you're just sort of wearing the 90s in that photo yeah. that you did
it's
come
like
up with. Chicago Bulls.
Someone had
and
said,
WWF.
We need a photo for the dictionary under 90s. David, what can you do?
It's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, what can I say? My memories of that period, tennis-wise, are rather happier than of my own life, more generally. So let's go back, shall we, and relive Rome from 1992, a year in which the Barcelona Olympics took place. Bill Clinton was elected President of the United States of America. Vinyl records were withdrawn from shops because of the rise of compact discs and audio cassettes. And Karolina Pliskova, Heather Watson and Jack Sock were born. I mean, that's a broad rundown of things that took place in 1992. But in Rome, which is the tournament we're reliving, because that would have been final weekend just gone, I found it so interesting to look at the role of honour of that tournament, which has always been such a good form guide for Roland Garros. I think it's the tournament that people tend to view as the most relevant, don't they? Because the clay is similar, the conditions feel quite similar, certainly compared to at that time when Hamburg was going on, and that was often cold and heavy. Andre Medvedev always used to win it because he could just sort of hit through it. And more recently, that's been replaced by Madrid, which is played at altitude and has got that slightly weird atmosphere inside the Kaya Mahica. And as a result of all that, Rome was always the one, wasn't it? And I think in many of the years, you can see a correlation between the two. And yet, here we are watching over the weekend, Gabriella Sabatini taking on Monica Seles in the final. Peak Seles, who had already won. What had she won that year, Matt? What was her role of honour at the Grand Slams?
Well, she'd won four of the last five slams, and she was in the middle of a run of reaching 33 finals out of 34 tournaments that she played from 1991 to 1993. You know, she was the clear number one in the world, and yeah, she just wasn't really losing many matches at all.
Mm. And yet Sabatini had won three of the last four titles. She'd beaten Seles in the final the year before. I also watched some highlights of that earlier in the day over the weekend. And I mean, they were very, very similar matches. Both matches she won in straight sets, and both sets of the match we saw, she came from behind. But I don't know. You tell me, Catherine, I couldn't take my eyes off Sabatini's tennis. Maybe it was partially because we knew we were covering her as our point of interest in this particular show. But you just get sort of drawn to her. I mean, you were probably too young to remember her tennis and understand tennis at that age. But having relived it now, what did you think?
I remember her hair. I remember asking my mum to do a French plait in the style of Gabriella Sabatini. I was mostly in tennis for the plaits at that stage. I had the Capriati double plait and the Sabatini French plait. I'd like to think my tastes have become slightly more sophisticated over the years. She is and was completely magnetic, wasn't she? It's funny, even as you say, she was down in both sets. Even when she was down, she was so clearly the better player. I mean, I'm looking forward to watching some matches over the French and Wimbledon where Monica Seles was totally in her pomp and showing all the brilliance that led to that run that Matt described. Because frankly, in this match that we watched yesterday, she was just second best throughout. She was completely outclassed by Gabriella Sabatini. She's made to look pretty lumbering at times by the touch and the variety of Sabatini. She instantly she reminded me of Amélie Mauresmo. It was a really stark comparison for me. That sort of the power is there, but it's deployed very sparingly. Quite often it's heavy topspin moon balls with knifed slice shown in, lovely thrown in, lovely touch at the net. But yeah, the ability to inject pace at will, and obviously the single-handed backhand comparison as well. I didn't really know that that was how she played her tennis. I guess I just thought, I know her slam came at the US Open, but in my head, sort of clay court specialist from South America, you get a picture in your mind of the brand of tennis they're likely to play. And goodness me, she was so much more than that.
What did you think, Matt, watching what we witnessed?
Well, I'd read a quote from Sabatini saying that she loves watching Ash Barty. And to then watch Sabatini play, that quote immediately made so much sense. The variety in Sabatini's game. I found it most fascinating the way she was able to use her slice on the clay as such a weapon. And in particular against Seles, the fact that she made Seles have to take her second hand off the racket and hit the ball with just her left hand. Obviously, Seles famously double-handed on both sides. That was how she was most comfortable hitting the ball. But so many times in this match, Sabatini actually used the slice to get a softer reply from Seles, having to take that hand off, and then use the forehand to sort of manoeuvre her around the court. And then obviously that... Obviously, the other thing that stood out was the connection that she had with the fans. I think it's interesting how we said this was her fourth title in Rome. Sometimes when a player is so dominant, the crowd can actually get, you know, can feel a bit apathetic towards it. They kind of want a new champion. But there was no sense of that with Sabatini whatsoever. They absolutely loved her. As you said, that this show actually coincides with the weekend Sabatini celebrated her 50th birthday, kind of coincidentally for us, really. But there's been a lot of articles about Sabatini. It's just been fascinating. And this match is actually featured in a lot of those articles. It feels like a defining moment in her career. And I read a line from La Nación, which is a newspaper in Argentina, which said that the centre court at the Foro Italico transformed into Gabilandia. And when she played, there was a special magnetism that radiated from the court. And even just watching on the screen, you can kind of feel that presence that she had on the court. So those were certainly the things that most struck me.
She was the perfect player for them in many ways, wasn't she? And she fed off their energy as well, it seemed to me. She's not a demonstrative player in terms of milking crowds or orchestrating or anything like that. But at the same time, some of the nonchalance at the net, for instance, when she would come in and set up volleys for herself and have total faith in her ability to just hit an exquisite touch shot. And it seemed to me she was almost overdoing the nonchalance more than she needed to, just because she knew the crowd would love that.
And because she could, and because it looked like it came as easily to her to hit a deft drop volley dug out from her feet as to hit a simple forehand put away. As my dad would put it, she was hitting 3 euro shots when 1 euro shots would have been enough, but she was making them every time. It was, you know, some of them were almost, you know, no look half volleys, weren't they? It was staggering.
That's it, actually. Yeah, it was. If there wasn't the kind of showboating in an in your face way, she wasn't trying to embarrass Seles, but she was just showing how good she is. She was letting every. It was. I suppose it's like a player with that kind of game who's just in the zone and feeling it and is going to show you.
And there's something so amazing about not only beating a player of Seles's quality in her prime, but doing it with style, doing it memorably, not completely catching Seles on a bad day. She imposed her own game and made Seles, as you said, look a little bit cumbersome at times.
As John McEnroe said after his 1983 Wimbledon final win over Chris Lewis, "I won it the way they wanted me to win it."
Mm.
Also, I think there are some kind of parallels to draw about her against Seles with players that play against Djokovic today, who has this relentlessness, and how are you on earth going to stop him and make him kind of malfunction? And there's one or two players that absolutely on their best day, maybe not even for the full duration of a match, but for periods, have the ability, have the variety to just mess him up and be able to take him out of his comfort zone. We saw, we'll go on to Federer in a little while from that find against Nadal. He had the same challenge against Nadal on clay. But Sabatini just could not have executed her game plan better. And she's basically won four sets in a row against her in Rome in the final. And as we were saying, we were watching the match and we were just kind of drooling about her tennis, and yet she was 4-1 down. And it didn't feel like that.
No, it never felt like she was down in the score, did it? And she made Monica Seles look pretty limited in that match. I mean, from quite early on, Monica Seles had a real dejection about her. And as we've said, that the magnetism of Gabriella Sabatini, it almost seemed to draw all of the aura that you would have expected Monica Seles to have with her ranking and prowess at the time. You could see her shrink. You could feel her shrink on that court, because Sabatini was just drawing everything towards her and into her orbit. And it was very strange to think that you're watching the world number one, the dominant player out there, because you just didn't look it during that match, did you? If an alien had dropped from space and it was just watching that tennis match and was asked to say, who's the world number one and favourite for everything at the moment, you would absolutely say Sabatini. What a shame that she didn't play for longer.
Yeah, well, that's right. She retired at the age of 26. What would it have been 4 years later, which is quite jarring to think about. And we will be covering another one of her great matches during Wimbledon, actually. We've already picked it out. So we won't go too deep into that just at the moment. There's plenty to be going on with. But yeah, it was a short career. I mean, that's the same age as Bjorn Borg retired for the first time, at least. But there's never been a comeback from Sabatini, and never a suggestion of one either.
She was Roger Federer's childhood crush, I read in a piece that Simon Briggs did on her late last week. But she's only 12 years older than Federer. You know, it's because of how young she retired. You think of her as someone from, you know, way, way back when. She hasn't been in our consciousness for so long. Maybe she's been doing punditry broadcast work in Argentina, but she's certainly not, to my knowledge and consciousness, been around tennis. And as you've pointed out in a couple of shows recently, David, unless you're in the greatest of all time debate, or you hold a record that a current player is chasing, or you're somebody that keeps themselves relevant by sort of saying controversial things about current tennis, you get forgotten. You get forgotten, and the longer ago your achievements were, the more that's the case. And Eve, she's only just turned 50, but somehow it feels like she's in tennis's distant past, which is such
and
a shame.
It's been one of the nice things, actually, of this weekend. Her turning 50 has made everybody remember her. There have been, as you say, lots of profiles, lots of the greats of the game remembering her. It was actually Steve Tignor whose piece about her turning 50 gave me that line. It was his line, to be fair: if you're not in the GOAT discussion, you're lucky to be in the discussion at all. What it did for me is it did jog my memory, because I have just suppressed so many tennis memories from that period of the time. And as we laugh about how I recall all this stuff from the 90s, it's because I'd got kind of almost coronavirus type time available to me, because I wasn't the faintest bit interested in my studies. And so all I was doing was watching tennis, and I've got all this stuff that just came bubbling up to the surface when I was watching this match. Just before I get onto that though, Matt, there was a moment in the match a couple of times when we all just laughed out loud because of the service return position that Sabatini was taking up. Describe that.
Well, yeah, Seles was serving on the deuce side, and I think almost the best way to be able to describe it is that Sabatini was returning from almost the ad side. She'd stepped so far across to get the ball on her forehand for the return. It was like intimidation tactics, mind game tactics. And yeah, I've never seen a return of serve position like that. It was like they were in a straight line down the middle of the court, the way they were both stood, Celis serving and Sabatini returning. And she did this multiple times. But the funny thing was, it wasn't like she would then tee off on the return and smack this forehand winner. She would play an aggressive shot, but she didn't really have that massive, powerful forehand in her arsenal. It was all in the mind games of saying, sort of tempting Celeste to hit a harder serve than she normally would. And yeah, it just worked a treat. And it's just a demonstration of how much she was thinking out there and how clever her tennis was.
What I loved about it was that she was creeping up as well. She was sort of tiptoeing as she did it, as though, can you see me? I'm just going to creep up to the service line now. Hello, I'm just in your peripheral vision here. You want to serve out there because I'm going to absolutely leather this if you don't. And of course, as you say, she really didn't have that sort of explosive game, but it was very, very funny to watch. I've not seen a court position quite like that before. I remember Tim Henman used to do quite a lot of moving around on the return, and I never felt it worked for him at all. It was sort of, you know, he used to kind of move in a lateral way just when the player was about to serve, which I'm not really sure you're supposed to do by the rules.
He did a little sort of gentle skip, didn't he, from side to side. It was very, very, very gentle.
And I tended to get the sense that the player down the other end was going, what are you doing? I mean, you think that's going to put me off? I mean, come on. But Sabatini back then, I mean, that was right in my wilderness years of lack of direction. But my word,
you're really making me worried about David Law circa 1992, David.
Well, yeah, there was plenty to be worried about, I can tell you. But
you've gone really dark.
Watching Sabatini play the other day, just watching it back, reminded me that I feel like she almost sort of, she didn't teach me how to play tennis because I can't play tennis really, but she taught me how to watch tennis. She taught me how strokes work. She taught me how the options, what you can do on a court. And I feel like the difference was in this match, there was a real purpose to every stroke. Sometimes if you watched old Sabatini matches, and it may be just because I was so young in my watching of it and not really understanding it yet, it was almost like I would play tennis computer games and think of Sabatini strokes, because I would think, right, if I move it here, I can hit a topspin backhand, or if I'd move it that way diagonally on the joystick, I can hit a slice backhand. And I would almost just do it for entertaining myself, just to see what happens if I do a topspin and what happens if I do a slice. And when you watch Sabatini at times, I kind of feel like that's almost going through her head. I could do anything with this ball. I could hit a moon ball. I could hit a nice short backhand slice. None of them will be fast enough to go for winners, but my word, did they look beautiful when they're just sort of painting the court like this.
Midway through the second set, she started drawing Celeste into moon balling, didn't she?
Yes.
And it was such a strange sight. I wondered if it was even intentional. But by that point, I think Celeste was just completely frazzled by the whole experience of playing Sabatini. She looks like the sort of player that would have made a great coach, because she so clearly has this mental understanding of the game, this instinctive understanding of the game. I mean, maybe that's a misunderstanding or a misconception of what makes a good coach, because actually when it's instinctive like that, that possibly makes it more difficult to impart to another person, because, oh, it just comes naturally to me. Why can't you do it? But she certainly, on the face of it, looks like the sort of player that would make a really great coach, because she just clearly has this understanding of court craft.
And I think, having read up about it, it sounds like she really taught herself, in a way, how to play at the net. When she came through on the tour, she was basically just a baseliner with these quite loopy ground strokes that maybe couldn't cause that much damage. But she realized that she needed more in her game, and she had the ability to play tuck shots, to sort of know instinctively how to cover the net. And then she taught herself to use it, which just shows a great tennis mind that I think she had. The point you made, David, about, well, that you've both made about how she's kind of been lost a bit from tennis's consciousness. I find it that at the time, if you were following Sabatini, that would have seemed unfathomable, because just how popular she was, how much of a big deal she was. And, you know, she probably doesn't have the slam record more than anything that would keep her in that conversation. But the achievement she did have, that, you know, she beat Steffi Graf more than anyone beat Steffi Graf. Okay, she lost a lot to Steffi Graf, but she got a lot of wins. She got an Olympic silver medal. She obviously won the US Open. I just think there's such a story there. And I was really pleased to see, actually, that she is still such a big deal in Argentina. I think she was a very important player for Argentina. I think, you know, she burst through. She reached she won Roland Garros Juniors in 1984. And that was just a year after a dictatorship had ended in Argentina. And I think a lot of the articles I was reading just made the point that they were ready for new possibilities, new people in Argentina, and she was that person, and people gravitated towards her, and that has stayed. Maybe she's been lost slightly in tennis history, but in Argentina she stayed. She's got national treasure status there, really.
Oh, Matt, you've hit my sweet spot. History. Plus sport.
Yeah, mine too.
And I think actually that's what, when I watch these matches, especially something like 1992, you've talked about the passage of time. And it really wobbled me a bit to think that it's 24 years ago that she retired. Such a long time, isn't it? It sounds like such a long time. And yet I remember this period so vividly. And I suppose because I was going through a period of my life of just not really knowing what I wanted to be or anything like that, or what the point was or anything. But I fell in love with tennis, and that's what defines the kind of path that my life would take. I just find it really, really cool that she's come to the forefront again. We talked to Mary Carrillo over the weekend about her as well. She reminded us how Sabatini grasped her opportunity only once at a Grand Slam to win a Grand Slam. That was the 1990 US Open. And she did it by, as you say, Matt, not only learning how to play at the net, but forcing it upon the opponent. Mm. She suddenly changed her line of attack and stopped faffing around from the baseline and showing all these wonderful options, and used it a bit like she did in this match against Seles to hurt the opponent. She beat Steffi Graf in that 1990 US Open final, despite basically winning 1 in 3 matches against her over the course of her career. Just imposed herself on Steffi Graf. And I mean, aside from that, she was a remarkably successful and consistent player. I think she reached 18 Grand Slam semifinals, but only won one title. And there were a lot of moments in her career, I think, when at the absolutely defining moment, she would come unstuck. The serve would get attacked. There was a really bad loss in 1993 at the French Open against Mary Jo Fernandez, when she was 6-1, 5-1 ahead and match point, and ended up losing.
I mean, I would never get over that. Ever. It was
painful to watch.
How do you ever get to a stage where you're not thinking about that every minute of every day?
Just to take this rivalry with Seles onwards a little bit, they then played in the French Open final after this Rome match, and she led 4-2 Sabatini in the final set and lost.
That was in the semis against Graf, wasn't it?
Yeah. And to think, you know, we've talked about how Sabatini just looked like the better player in that match against Seles that we just watched. To think she would never beat Seles again. That was her final win.
Oh, really?
Against Seles. And I've seen a lot of things this weekend celebrating Arsenal's Invincibles beating Leicester on the final day. And then people saying, imagine walking out of that stadium being told that Leicester would win the league before Arsenal again. It's kind of like that with Celeste and Sabatini. Once you've seen that match, you think, well, Sabatini, how can she not win loads more and come to dominate maybe this rivalry? But just doesn't work out that way. Just one more point on the kind of poignancy of it. We watched the closing ceremony, and this is more a Celeste point, but the interviewer said to Monica Celeste, who when you saw her interviewed, you saw how young she was, that she was still a teenager. And they said, we'll see you next year. Which, as Catherine said now, that's such a haunting line, because, of course, Celeste didn't make it to Rome the next year. She was, the match where she was stabbed was a couple of weeks before. And yet, at Rome in 1993, players were asked what to do about Celeste's ranking, whether it should be frozen number one. And I'm not sure whether this was known at the time. All the sources I've heard have cited Celeste's autobiography for this line, and that Sabatini was the only player who abstained from voting. The WTA wanted to freeze the ranking, but for some reason they asked the players, and all the top players, apart from Sabatini and Graf, who wasn't there, but all the others said, no, it shouldn't be frozen. And in the end, her ranking wasn't frozen. But Sabatini objected to that, and Celeste, you know, has talked about how much she appreciates Sabatini for that moment, for thinking as a person, as a human, rather than just focusing on the rankings and the business side of things. Just, I thought it was an interesting how they stayed connected in that way after this match.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing to remember. And I mean, that what an episode in tennis's history. Obviously, not just the horrific thing that happened to Monica Seles, but those chapters that unfolded afterwards. I didn't know about that. Why were the players asked for that? That's like asking turkeys to vote for Christmas, isn't it? Or not to vote for Christmas. That's a strange and eerie chapter in tennis history. And it really hit me in the gut when she was asked. I think the questioner just says, so you'll come back and get revenge on the centre court next year then? She says, yeah, with a bit of luck, I hope so.
Yeah, it's hard to hear, isn't it? Mary said of Sabatini that, as somebody who dealt with her, really liked her, said she was not a quote machine, but she was just really, she had a really nice way about her. I found her view of why Rome took to her so much quite interesting. This is what Mary said. She says, Italians loved Sabatini and claimed her as one of their own. They did the same with Agassi. I think the Italian Open is one of the most emotional tournaments in the world, at least when she covered it. And in as much as they would pick certain players and they'd go crazy for them. Panatta, obviously, Vitas Gerulaitis, they loved as well. People that loved Rome, they loved back, and it was that kind of relationship.
Yeah, well, Djokovic has an amazing relationship with the fans there. I mean, he speaks Italian, he's got a relationship with Italy. Serena Williams as well has developed this really emotive relationship with Rome, because it's where she met her husband, and she made the effort to speak a bit of Italian, I think, to the fans. And yeah, it's, of course, Sabatini has Italian heritage as well, which a lot of Argentines do. It's an Italian sounding name, I think, so that would have helped. But certainly it goes far beyond that, the connection that she has with that crowd. It's like, yeah, it's something sort of Del Potro-esque, isn't it? It's just, can't quite put your finger on it. It's impalpable, but it's undeniably there.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare.
PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. So that was 1992. Let's fast forward to 2006 and Roger Federer is dominating all before him in tennis generally. Rafael Nadal is dominating all before him on that particular surface and also dominating the head-to-head between himself and Roger Federer so far, because looking at the stats of that year is, I think, one of the most hard-hitting moments in tennis history, certainly recently, just the extremes that we're talking about. I think Nadal was, with the victory that he would have against Federer in that final, he would break Guillermo Vilas's record for consecutive match wins on clay. And Federer, I think, had a record for the year of 92 wins and 5 defeats, and he only lost to 2 players. And one of them was Andy Murray in a single match. The other 4 defeats were all against Nadal. And it just had everything, really. When we came to watch this match, I realised I had never seen it before. I'd obviously heard about it. I'd seen Match Point. I'd seen the celebration. But I happened to be getting married the day before that particular final. So I was unable to watch tennis for one weekend of my life. And so to actually go back in time and watch this contest between Nadal really early on in his career. I mean, he'd won the 2005 French Open and then was coming in as the big favourite to do it again. He would just sweep everybody before him on that particular surface, and yet Federer was at his absolute peak at the same time. And I mean, even rewatching it, it had that feel of the heavyweight championship of the world, the two best players on the planet, and nobody knows until the very last ball who's going to win. I mean, it's 5 hours and 15 minutes, something like that. And it lived up to it. I absolutely was hanging on it, particularly in that final set.
And it was tense right from the word go, which at the start of a 5-set match is rarely the case. The crowd and the players were just 100% dialed in right from the word go. You just sort of, I mean, obviously we had the benefit of hindsight, but you just had the feel of an epic on the first point. And the commentator Jason Goodall described them as arch rivals midway through the match, and I thought, well, at this stage, I think, Matt, they had only actually met once in a Grand Slam.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
It was really, really early days in their rivalry. Roger Federer was Nadal had won the one Grand Slam at the French Open the previous year, and Federer was the completely dominant player. They had not developed into anything like the arch rivals that we know them to be now. So it's a comment that's obviously aged incredibly, incredibly well. And he was right. Somehow, even though the numbers didn't yet back it up at that stage, it still felt, you could just tell that they were meant to be together on the court. They sort of completed one another. Mm. It felt like an incredibly special match and quite a potentially defining match in their arch rivalry.
Yeah, it just shows how early Nadal was on Federer's case, really. I think it is an interesting and important match because for me, I see it as a what if. You know, if Federer had won this match, he had two match points. I'm sure we'll get into the match more, but he had two match points to win in the fifth set and didn't take them. He missed forehands on both. And if Federer, I mean, we'll never know the answer to this, but if Federer had managed to get a win early in his career against Nadal on clay, how that could have potentially changed the way that their rivalry would then unfold, particularly at Roland Garros for the next few years. You know, Federer has still never won three sets on clay against Nadal in a match. He's never done it. And this was the closest he came.
And that's the fascination, that this was best of five on a very similar surface to Roland Garros. Mm-hmm. Warm conditions, bit windy. It had Nadal's perfect conditions on it, and Federer nearly won.
And Federer was the better player at that stage on that day, even on clay. Roger Federer was the better tennis player. I mean, that was Federer. I mean, he's added things to his game, obviously, most notably, particularly against Nadal. His backhand has improved, or his ability or confidence in taking the backhand early. But at that stage, Federer is pretty much in his pomp, the complete tennis player. He's got everything. Nadal is rough around the edges. He's brilliant. You can see all of the raw materials, but he's the shadow. He's the shadow of the player that he ended up developing into, really. Federer was the better tennis player then, and really ought to have won, and he knew it. He was crestfallen afterwards.
It was such a simple problem he had against Nadal, but seemingly had such a complex solution. I just remember him not being able to figure it out for so long, and this was probably the match where he came closest. I think his backhand actually held up pretty well in this match. In my mind, I picture their early clay court matches as Nadal pinning Federer in the backhand corner, and Federer's backhand not really making it past the service line, and Nadal, you're waiting for the one where he goes down the line and just hits it into the space. But in this, Federer's backhand stood up pretty well. He hit his forehand well throughout the match, apart from just when he needed to, and he got to the net. He came to the net 84 times on clay. I mean, I know it was a long match, but his commitment to coming forward, he was executing most of the time. He just wasn't quite executing when he needed to, and those were the moments when Nadal raised his game, and he would not miss in those crucial moments. They both sort of had this limitless number of gears that they could seemingly go into, and Nadal would save time his for the biggest moments, and Federer wouldn't necessarily. And when Nadal was dialed in, Federer became a little bit confused. It became less sort of instinctive tennis. You could see him thinking about it more, and ultimately, those are little moments that made the difference in this absolutely epic match.
It was clear that Nadal was already in his head that stage, because Federer's backhand was at its worst in the first set. It was like he walked onto the court thinking, my backhand isn't up to the pressure Nadal's going to apply. So he started doing strange chip type shots on the backhand, which just obviously weren't going to get the job done. He was running around onto the forehand, and actually once he sort of, I'm not sure quite what clicked it into gear, once he started believing in the backhand and thinking that it could stand up to the scrutiny, it by and large it did. As Matt said, I was quite surprised by how well it stood up, but it's funny that in the first set it was when he seemed to have no confidence in it at all, indicating that he must have walked onto court with mental baggage about the way Nadal exposes his backhand, which, you know, at that early stage in their rivalry is amazing to think.
That turning around of rivalries is one of the great features of Federer's career, and one I've always been fascinated by. If you go back right to the beginning, he had a really heavy deficit against Tim Henman. He had a very heavy reverse scoreline in the head-to-head against Agassi and Leighton Hewitt and David Nalbandian.
Mm.
And he turned them all around. I mean, we're talking multiple defeats, sort of 6-1, 6 down and things like that in those sort of head-to-heads. And he turned all of them around. And I remember reporting on him back then. I remember going to the tournament in Dubai, for instance, that year. I was covering that tournament and they met each other in the final. And I remember distinctly thinking, right, okay, Nadal's got these wins against Federer on clay. He beat him in the French Open semis last year. He won't do it on hard court. Nadal's game is not transferable onto that surface. And I'd seen enough losses from Nadal on hard court against players like Andy Roddick and people like that to think that Federer's just going to make mincemeat out of him on the surface. And he didn't. Federer started, I think Federer might have started like a train and got about 5 love up in the first set in Dubai and ended up losing in 3. And that really rocked me, really surprised me. Given how well Federer was playing, I think he was unbeaten that year until that match. And then they'd played each other in Monte Carlo on clay. That was 4 sets 2 weeks earlier. Then they came in and played this match. And it was the moment that I agree with you. I think it could well have been a crossroads for Federer in terms of turning that rivalry around. Maybe not. I mean, he beat him in Hamburg the following year, but that always felt different. That was best of 3 sets. It was heavy clay. Nadal had already won everything and was clearly not quite there, and Federer was going all out. This was the one. This was the one where they were both at kind of ground zero and ready to find out who's the best. And Federer chucked everything at him. He won the first set 7 love on a tiebreak, lost the next 2. And I thought his performance in the 4th set in getting him back was really something. Because, I mean, normally you tended to feel that in that rivalry, once Nadal got the upper hand in the match, 2-1 or whatever, leveled a match, that's it on clay. And Federer did a fantastic job. And I just found it really interesting how effective his game was, and the forehand was really powerful and dominating when he wanted to pull the trigger. And then, as you say, he gets himself 2 match points, and they were really bad misses. They were just, they should not have happened for Roger Federer.
Even when you know they're coming, they make you wince and cringe a little bit.
They made me think of John Wertheim's poem.
Mm.
That Matt read out to us.
Slash song.
Slash song, yes. Song converted into poem due to Matt's reluctance to sing on the podcast. Yeah, about
anywhere,
him having no nerve, which obviously is a total exaggeration, but he blew it. He blew it, and he knew that he blew it. I was going to say he blew it and he knew it. I ended up saying it anyway. But yeah, it was writ large on his face that he...
We've got such levels of extreme here, haven't we? Because Roger Federer, I think, has won over 1,000 matches. He's won 20 slam singles titles. He knows how to finish matches off. I mean, that much is clear. And yet, we've got that record of him losing matches from match point up. And even in this match, as a microcosm, the moment Nadal got his chance to finish the match, there was none of this missing. Now, I know he plays with a greater margin for error, etc., but it feels to me on the whole, Nadal, and I've seen him choke just that once maybe in the Wimbledon final of 08, but generally speaking, he just knuckles down. Plan A, I'm going to keep on pounding away and I'm not going to miss, and eventually I'll get my way. And Federer does have a capacity to miss and to lose more so on when he's done the hard work, when he's on the brink.
Mm. It's one of the great paradoxes of his career, as you said, the fact that he has won so much and yet he has got this record. This was one of 22 matches that he's lost from match point up. But I do think a large part of it is game styles. Federer's game, as you said, it's so high risk. You know, those two match points, certainly the second one, he really went for it on the forehand. And high risk tennis is not built for pressure moments. It's incredible. It just goes to show how incredible he is that he's managed to win so much with a game style that perhaps, you know, is risky and doesn't favour him at the important moments. He's obviously executed a lot more times than he's fluffed it up, but when he does make a mess of it, it really, really does stand out. I was so glad this match stood up to the test of time. You know, this did a bit like the way you were talking about 1992 being formative years for you with tennis. This is very much it for me. I have a vivid memory of the playground at school, actually. What did you do at the weekend? Oh, I watched a five-hour tennis match, and it was this one. I think I would probably say the 2008 Wimbledon final to non-tennis fans is the kind of match that most sticks out from my childhood of watching tennis. But to tennis fans, I would point to this one because they would probably know what I meant, and it really did stand up. Other than a lull in the second set, the quality was sustained, the drama, and what we've said, the way it told the stories of who Federer and Nadal were as tennis players, both at that point in their careers and also what they would develop into. It's just a perfect microcosm.
At that stage, Matt, did you own the three-quarter length trousers and sleevelet? You did, okay.
No, I'm not sure I ever had a sleeveless Nadal shirt. Yeah. I was aware even then that would have looked ridiculous.
You had the trousers, but the trousers. Not the... If only John McEnroe had been aware.
A couple of things that occurred to me watching it. Just the sheer fascination with Federer, who did already feel to me like the greatest player I'd ever seen, and he'd only won half a dozen slams by then. I know that's still a lot, but he hadn't won anything like what he would go on to win. But he felt like the greatest player I'd ever seen, and watching him try to decode Nadal on that surface, and his self-belief still, okay, maybe he wobbled just at that last second, but he backed himself without what he would develop later with Edberg and Ivan Ljubicic. He hadn't yet got that, right, I'm going to just crowd the court and not move from the baseline and just take everything on and just take your time away. Back then, he was happy to trade. He was backing his ability from behind the baseline with his movements and his clay court game to take on Nadal. He was still thinking that would maybe get the job done. And it shows what an incredible clay court player he was that he never got really the credit for because he was always up against Nadal. And I don't know. I just feel like it just defines them as players and their equally the fact that Nadal was taking on this absolute colossus on everything. And yet he still had the ability on that surface, and he would eventually develop it on others as well, to be the man, to be the kryptonite.
Yeah, and to think that he was the man at that stage, and he was only 19, and as I referenced earlier, really a shadow of the player he ended up being. I mean, at that stage, Nadal's serve is a dolly clay court serve. His first and second serves are pretty much the same speed. He's just getting the rally started. That's it.
He got
it.
The first one in more than 80% of the time in all five sets. As you say, he's just starting the rallies.
He's just starting the rallies. No ambition to do anything more with it.
And actually, I think Federer should have been more aggressive on the return. He basically only jumped around his backhand once in the match, and it was in the final set tiebreak when he did it, and he was really aggressive and he won the point. And this goes back to what I was saying, he had the answers in his game. As you were saying, he was the more complete player. He just couldn't quite figure out how to deploy it at the right time, whereas Nadal made the absolute most of what he had. And that was just so cool to see Nadal just come good in those big moments. He did it time after time, and especially against Federer. And I just remember being just in awe of how he was able to do it.
And just seeing a 19-year-old, I mean, obviously it helped that he was a 19-year-old that had delivered. He had won a Grand Slam title, but just own the court against the world number one and the guy that people were already talking about is the potential greatest of all time, even back then. You know, the roundhouse fist pumps, the double jumping air fist pumps.
He was so cool,
and he wasn't afraid to own the court and to dominate aura wise, which so many of the young players that we hype and sort of have to hype and sometimes justifiably hype and sometimes not, they don't have even a fraction of what Nadal had as a young player.
Yeah. It was all within. It wasn't, there was no show, there was no putting it on for effect. It was just coming, exploding out of him as he felt it. Harvey Araton in the New York Times wrote in a headlined piece that said Federer Nadal starting to have that Frazier Alley ring. His intro says, Nadal has dropped into Federer's space like a boulder onto a bridge sent by the competition gods to be the litmus test for tennis immortality.
That's good.
There was some aggro as well, wasn't there, Matt?
I think I missold the aggro because there wasn't really aggro during the match. The aggro unfolded in comments after the match where Federer, he accused Tony Nadal of, Uncle Tony, of doing Mouratoglou-style courtside coaching. I was watching, hoping that I had remembered correctly that there was mid-match on-court aggro, but alas, no, it was all very convivial. But afterwards, Federer had a bit of a pop.
Yeah, he said, "I've told him many times already through the entire match in Monte Carlo to stop coaching, but it seems like they don't keep a close enough eye on him." And it was funny because the question was actually framed as I heard you say something to Tony, and the journalist was referring to Tony Roach. He thought he'd picked up on Federer saying something to his coach, and Federer was like, no, that was for Tony Nadal. sort of interesting just misunderstanding there. But what you were saying about Fraser Alley is another point that it felt like more than a match. It felt like an event. It felt like something you just had to watch at the time. Just looking at their record, they played a 5-set match, Federer and Nadal, every year, at least one for 5 straight years, from 2005 to 2009. And every single one, you just felt like you had to watch it because maybe on clay, this would be the moment that Federer would beat Nadal, or on grass, this would be the moment that Nadal would beat Federer. Hard court, they were more even. And there was just that storyline that just followed them and has followed them throughout their career. And it was really born in these 2005, 2006 years. It's just so good to go back and watch them.
Another cracking atmosphere, wasn't it, as well?
Mm.
It's intoxicating. You feel it's, there's a kind of hysteria about it all. You feel as though you're a bit drunk on it. You just don't want to leave. You're like, you're in the pub having the best time and you don't want the night to end.
From the very, very first moment, it was like the start of a theatre show or something. It was just hush descended, and it was electric from the first moment. It was just, there is no way that this cannot be a good match. You're not worried. I mean, obviously, I'm watching this with hindsight, but I did watch it live, and there's no worry that it'll disappoint, that you know, as we were talking about with the worst ever Grand Slam finals, is it worse when one's been massively hyped and it ends up being utter crap, or is it worse when you're expecting one to be crap and it's crap? It's that anxiety that you desperately want and hope and think something's going to be brilliant and it ends up not being, and there was none of that anxiety for this match. It just didn't seem conceivable that it would disappoint.
And that is the best thing about going to sport, isn't it? Live sport, where there's an expectation before it starts, just hangs in the air. In fact, it's not just sport, as you said, it's theatre, it's music concerts, and then out of nothing, there's nothing, and then suddenly it's all there in front of you. And there was just this appreciation for both players. Maybe they slightly wanted Federer to win, I think, perhaps by the end, but it felt just fair, even support for both players and just an appreciation of what they were both bringing to the court and a recognition that it was a special rivalry developing.
And it was quite interesting from an evolution of Nadal's pre-serve routine point of view as well, because it was quite primitive back then, the pre-serve fidgeting.
It's kind of a devolution and an evolution. He's lost the he's lost the way he picks at his shoes and socks. He doesn't do that anymore. And yet that was the main part of his routine back then. And yet he's developed all this tics with his face and touching his ears and his nose and his ears and his nose and his ears and his nose several times before he serves. But there was none of that back then.
No, it was mostly centred on the socks. Matt and I were fast-forwarding through the change of ends to shave a bit of time off the rewatch. And so we would sync up at the start of after every sit-down. And every time I paused to sync up, Nadal was bending over, adjusting his socks. Every single time my screen seemed to be paused on Nadal bending over.
Just one final thought from me about it. I remember when we covered, Catherine, the US Open final last year when Nadal played Medvedev. And I said at the time, he made me almost scared for him with how deep he had to dig, with how far he was prepared to go in order to win. And watching him at the end of this match, sort of crouching down on his haunches and sitting down on his chair and putting his head in his hands, I saw then how much this takes for him to do it. You just get these little tells at the end of matches with Nadal. It's not put on. It's not. He manages to stay in this bubble of focus and intensity and present throughout these incredibly long periods of time. And then at the end, you can see him just collapse emotionally and physically and mentally. And I often worry for him almost because I feel that normal human beings have a bit of a limiter on themselves as to how hard they're willing to push before they think, oh, I'm not sure that's actually safe. I'm not sure that I will be able to handle that. I'm not able to do that in my life, in things that I do, and I don't think most people are. And I think, aside from his otherworldly ability, his preparedness to push himself through those pain barriers is just mind-blowing.
It's funny, I was just going to say, if you asked me to name somebody else that doesn't have a limiter on themselves, I would say David Law. I mean, maybe not physically.
Not in tennis.
But in other respects, I'd say you do have that characteristic.
Hence why we're doing 20 shows in about 3 weeks.
You just go and go and go without giving it a second thought and then just drop dead.
Yeah, there are times when you can email or text David at any time of the day and you'll get a reply. If you're in a different time zone or whatever, David is always up.
What you don't know is I've cloned myself.
He was sobbing, I think, at the end of that match, Nadal. Sobbing into his towel, which
and I think
was
that
pretty
that
arresting
more,
sight.
More than you really focus on, I think that happens. There have been a couple of French Open finals when he's won, and one or two when you're thinking, well, that looked quite straightforward. But I think it discounts what it took to get him there. Sometimes getting over the injuries or the disappointments and the frustrations and all those sort of things and how much he must keep contained. And then it just comes out. And I love that about him. I love watching what it means to these players at the end.
And also how aware he is of his own limits. You know, the next week he withdrew from Hamburg. So clearly, you know, he probably could have won Hamburg, but he knew that Rome tournament has taken so much out of me. I now need to get ready for the French Open. We talk so much now about the big three in terms of their scheduling and how sensible they are with it. But I think even back then, it was something they were aware of and did better than other people.
Yeah, that Hamburg 2006 draw took quite a hammering. I suspect the tournament organisers were watching that Rome final with their heads in their hands, thinking, no, please end soon, please end soon. Yeah, because I think it was a 1-3-3 Robredo Stepanek final in Hamburg, which, with all due respect to those two players, is not.
Who did he beat, Robredo?
5 hours of Federer and Nadal. Stepanek, that well-known clay courter.
Blimey.
And the semi-finalists were even weirder. Hang on a second.
One of them was Acassuso.
Yes, Jose Acassuso.
who beat top seed Ivan Ljubicic 6-2, 6-love in like the second round or something.
Yes. Wow. So it's actually a really interesting draw. You've got Andy Murray beating Gael Monfils in round one and then losing to James Blake. You have got Novak Djokovic.
Qualifier
Novak Djokovic, hang on a second, beating Fernando Verdasco even better than that, you've got Novak Djokovic as a qualifier beating Guillermo Coria 6-3 in the third in the opening round and then losing to Fernando Verdasco in the second round.
Wow.
But yes, the semi-finals were Robredo beating Ancic and Stepanek beating Jose Acassuso.
Wow. Yes, slightly different billing there. Yeah. But there are probably some good matches and stuff. But you're right. I mean, as organisers, when you're a Masters 1000, which that was just the same as Rome, that's a tough one to take.
Max Mirny was a quarter finalist. I mean, these are not names that I associate with big clay court results.
And they ended up switching them around dates-wise, if you look, and it's part of the reason why, because Rome was more similar to Roland Garros. Mm. And obviously Madrid ended up taking over, but the view was that you're better off having Rome close to Roland Garros.
Robin Söderling was a lucky loser in the draw.
Wow.
I love looking back at these old draws.
Yeah. Robin Söderling, who Matt's spoken to today. As part of our preparations for Roland Garros Relived, which all starts on Sunday, as we talk to you now. Next Sunday, we're going to be bringing you 15 podcasts in 15 days, looking back on the great moments. And we'll release all of our matches to you over the next couple of days to let you know what we're going to cover, on which day, where you can watch them with us. And we've spoken to so many different people. It's going to be great. I hope you'll enjoy it with us. So, just before we finish, I forgot to give you my 2006 trivia, guys. The 2006 Football World Cup was held in Germany, won by Italy. It was the hottest month ever in Britain that year, in July. I remember that. Daniel Craig made his debut as James Bond in Casino Royale. Blu-ray discs were launched in the United States of America. And George W. Bush greeted Tony Blair with the phrase, "Yo, Blair." Those things happen.
What a strange collection of facts.
Well, that's what you come to the Tennis Podcast for when I'm presenting it, whether you like it or not. Is there anything else, folks?
If you buy me a bit of time, I can find some shout outs.
Yeah, give me a shout out. Catherine, what were you doing in 2006? Let's just remind ourselves. We know that my life was falling apart in 1992.
First half of it, I was just in my second year of uni having a below average time. But the second half of it, I was on my year abroad in La Réunion in the Indian Ocean, an island Indian Ocean. And it was great. It was technically studying, but I did a module in surfing, I recall.
What?
Yeah, module in surfing. I did a module in something called aqua randonnée, which literally translated means water hiking, but it's like jumping down waterfalls and stuff. It was great, put it that way. It was great.
I mean, it kind of sounds it, yeah.
I'm sorry, I feel bad now describing that while your life was falling apart, but I didn't know you at the time.
And my life had sort of got
back
itself together again.
Yes.
Yeah, I was a married man.
Oh, sorry, it was 92 when your life was falling apart.
I'd had a magnificent wedding in 2006, and I was very happy. So it had just taken me the 14 years, you know. Matt was about nine, and Matt's got some shout-outs.
Oh, is it a quiz? Sorry, there is something else.
Oh, yeah, of course there is, because, yes, we're not going to come back on Thursday, folks. I draw the line, all right? This is me pulling out a Hamburg like Nadal. we're not doing a Thursday show.
Well, we are still doing two pods this week.
Yes, because we're doing one on Sunday, and the Sunday one is amazing. The Sunday one you have got to listen to, because we're going to be featuring Yannick Noah's run to the title in 1983, and we've got a wonderful interview with him, which we'll share some of that in that show, and I tell you, you do not want to miss that.
Yeah, speaking of cool, Yannick Noah.
The coolest man I've ever met in my life, bar none. And so, but before that, I am going to take on our predictions Kickstarter backers in a quiz and win. So I can't wait. And Catherine and Matt are running it.
Because we're unable to obviously provide any tennis for our predictions Kickstarter backers to predict. I mean, we could give you relived matches to predict, but I don't think that would be much of an enjoyable contest, although people would have a chance of beating David. So Matt and I are fulfilling our fantasies of being tennis quiz masters on Saturday. So the Kickstarter backers will be coming at the king. And that is the one and only time I will call you that, David. So please, all quiz participants that are listening, start revising French Open history, because I implore you, we need one of you to beat David, please.
Yeah, emphasis on need.
Yeah.
We'll let you know if they manage to do so in Sunday's show. Can't wait.
There are two big concerns. One is technology failing us, and the second is David winning. And I think,
and they've
both
managed
are quite
to
likely
guarantee neither at the moment. So
maybe David's technology will fail him, and problem solved.
No, he's got a new router.
Yeah,
yeah. And I've got my Mickey Mouse T-shirt on as well, so I'm ready. I'm ready to go. Right. Okay. Well, lovely to talk to you both about Rome in 1992 and 2006. I'll see you again on this very screen in this very office in about 5 days' time. Have we got any shout-outs, Matt?
I have now found them, yes.
Go on then.
Shout-outs to Richard Nuttall.
Hello,
cheers,
Richard.
To Zihong Yao.
Hello, Zihong Yao.
And to Heather M.
Oh, Heather, incognito.
But thank you.
Are there any
very
famous
much
Heather M's? Could it be a famous?
Does sound like the name of somebody on stage and screen, doesn't it?
I've got a Heather W, Heather L, Heather. No, that's all I've got.
Heather McCartney.
This is what tennis podcast listeners want, isn't it?
It's all right. No one's listening anymore. It's the end.
No. Right, so let's go.
Heather Locklear.
Well, all right, okay. Keep your eye on our social media channels, because we are coming at you over the next month with Roland Garros and Wimbledon Relived daily shows, some wonderful interviews that tell the stories, bring them alive from some of the greatest moments in tennis history here on the Tennis Podcast. That's what we're going to be doing. Thank you for listening to this one. Do tell your friends. If you're in one of those sort of tennis club WhatsApp groups, send our link out. It's in the show notes of your phone right now. Send our link out to all your WhatsApp friends and get them listening to us as well. Leave us a review on iTunes if you wouldn't mind as well, as long as it's 5 stars. If it's 0 stars, go away. And we'll speak to you soon here on the Tennis Podcast. Thanks for your company, and see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.